Accession number 10167, Reel 6.
Mr. Ronald Elliott, Reel 6. You were telling me about the aftermath of the Salerno Mutiny, as it's sometimes called.
Yeah. The next stage of the campaign was in the mountains, which were regarded as being the key to the opening out of the bridgehead into the plain at Naples and the capture of Naples. And that battle was quite a bitter battle and involved supplying of forward companies with materials, food and ammunition. And a lot of people who I know had been on the detachment from North Africa were used as carrying parties, some of which had a bad time and were killed or captured. So a lot of people might have been captured anyway. Now, there's another aspect of it that some undoubtedly of people who were in North Africa and in this camp were shell shock cases, what we call bomb happy cases, which we might talk about. And the trouble with bomb happy cases really is that once they're away from the immediate war situations, no one can tell really whether they're genuinely ill or not. And no one can tell really whether they're likely to revert or not. And it was my feeling that part of this problem was many of the people who were in this situation on that detachment were probably bomb happy cases, either actual or intended. People who'd had a long battle, or a long series of battles, and at the first sign of any action, of shot or shell, just reverted to being bomb happy and sort of worked their way back again through the system. And of course, this was to happen, I think, throughout the whole of the campaign.
So they didn't accept this offer of going to their original unit because they'd already been. They were once again out of it.
They're probably out of it, yeah. So, I mean, that's all supposition, but I know some of it did exist. I don't know how many people did actually respond to it, but from what I heard, not many in our unit, the 16th.
Now, that's slightly ahead of ourselves in one sense, but where were the 16th when you joined them, and what sort of reception did you get? What company were you put in? And how was
well, I was quite pleased when I arrived at the 16th, because for the first time I got into the signals, which is, you know, what I'd been aiming to do right throughout all this time I'd been abroad.
So
for me, I was quite chuffed at that.
You were put in the signal section of the headquarters company?
Yes, they were somewhat short of staff, so I was in the signals and started off in battalion headquarters on the sort of reserve sets. We'll talk about the organisation of the signals later on, shall we?
If that's more convenient.
Well, yes, because there wasn't a lot to the next stage, although the battle was rather tough. I didn't see a lot of it because I'm somewhat further back. We were in what was known as Corpo de Carva, which was a mountain position prior to the breakout into the plain of Naples, and after some quite rugged fighting and some very good tactics on part of the battalion. All of the positions of the heights were taken and the Germans withdrew, and it led subsequently to the fall of Naples. And there wasn't any battle in Naples. The Germans just pulled right back. And
during this stage, you were sort of in reserve.
Yes, I didn't have a lot to do. I was just with a reserve set.
What was your initial impression of the 16th as compared to the 9th?
There was this feeling, I guess, and I really didn't have a lot of experience to support it, but the feeling that the 16th was somewhat below par, being a non... what was the term? They were not a regular regiment.
But the 9th were only territorials.
Yes, but the 16th, of course, were even further out than that. I mean, they were a very temporary wartime effort. So people in there would tend to look down, and I think I went along with that feeling that the 16th were perhaps not quite up to standard. But I think this period of time, and we'd come to it later on, I guess, I believe from then onwards, for the most of the first part of the Italian campaign, the 16th probably did some of its best work. And it was very well led, very experienced, and on the whole, quite a good professional unit. And what happened, of course, is an attrition aspect on it. In this stage, they still had most of their experienced people still with them, so they were still a fully equipped and fit.
What did you have to do on the reserve set then? What were your duties or role?
I was just standing by in case I was needed. At times I took part in the sort of network while working forward to other signals who were with the companies that were working outwards. And it really didn't involve very much, and I certainly wasn't under any great pressure. And after we'd got through this mountainous area, the front moved on apace beyond that, and it wasn't our job. I think the armour went in really to take Naples. I think they were the first people into Naples, together with Mark Clark. And we stayed in a rest area in a farm, as I remember it. And we all sort of got together then. And this is a suitable time, I think, to talk about the sort of way in which the signals really operated. On the occasions when the battalion was wholly at rest, all of the signal members who were in terminals, the terminals out at companies, all came back into headquarters, and we then became a signal section, and we all got together, and everyone enjoyed that, because really, in normal circumstances, you didn't meet your opposite numbers very often, and these were times when we all got together, and later on, of course, we were all great mates, and it was a good time when everyone was together. But this only happened fairly rarely. So we all looked forward to being together and chatting over what we'd done, meeting comrades in arms. And there was another aspect to it, the sort of the class side of it, that there was a more intense camaraderie between those people who were really out with companies, who were in the front line, and those who were sort of in the base echelons. And there was a large measure of suspicion and even contempt for those who didn't get too far forward, so that there was a more intense camaraderie between those who were wholly engrossed in actual company work and those who were not. And in fact, the signal company had an officer, a sergeant. We had two sergeants at one stage. One was a land sergeant, but sergeant and two corporals, and a technical corporal who actually repaired the set. And they were mostly either at base echelon or F echelon, and sometimes battalion headquarters. They hardly ever got very far forward at all. And most of the real nitty-gritty of the work was done by just the ordinary. Quite a small group of people who are generally the ones who, in fact, did the forward signal work. And it's in the nature of things that if you looked at all good and were able to stick it out, they kept you there. So, you know, they're the same people tended to be the ones who went out to companies. So that was really the background to the way the signals operated and how the signals life developed over the course of the next year or so. Because I, in the beginning at that stage, was just taken into headquarters, but I came out fairly quickly after that.
What equipment was being used in the field at the time?
We had 18 sets then. They subsequently changed to something more modern, which I think were 38s, but I'm not sure. But 38s or 48s, I forget which. It was an 18 set. It was quite heavy. 30, 40 pounds, I would think. The full extent of the equipment that one had to carry for any infantryman was quite remarkable. But the signal terminal, there were three of you, usually, at a company in these times. Later on, it became even tougher, but usually three. And you had to carry the set, which was very heavy. And when you were in operation, you had to have the aerial up, which stuck up about another 5 feet. And walking along through vineyards with an aerial like that really was quite impossible at times. And there is a story I tell, which is that there was one occasion, many months later, I guess, where we were advancing as a company along the edge of this wall. And the Germans had a fixed machine gun firing along the top of the wall. And I had this set on with the big aerial. And we all bobbed down behind the wall as best we could. Then the bloke in front of me farted. And I really didn't know what to do, whether to stay down and be gassed because the stench was absolutely horrible in those days, or stand up and be shot to death. So you had all these hazards. But then, to get back to the equipment, we had to carry two spare batteries, which were big, thick things, like bricks, some spare equipment like headsets and that sort of thing, together with all of our usual equipment, although there was a concession that whoever was carrying the set usually didn't have a weapon, his personal weapon, and we would have probably one Tommy gun and a rifle amongst the three of us, together with our usual kit and things like picks and shovels if we were in that sort of mood. So really a heavy job carrying all this equipment.
There'd be three of you attached to each company.
Yes.
Of which one would be a corporal, a lance corporal?
Quite often, if they had them, they didn't always have lance corporals, really.
You were a corporal.
Well, I went up and down. You know, sometimes I was a lance corporal, and other times I wasn't. When I first joined them, they had a few lance corporals who were in charge of the terminal, who were IC terminals. But later on, because of the movement, they didn't bother to make people up. So they didn't tend to have much in the way of any sort of commissions out in terminals at all. That just happened to be the way it was, actually.
So there were three of you. What were the jobs within the group of three?
We used to take it in turns, actually. Carrying the set was usually quite hard work. And what it, in theory, although it didn't always work out that way, you would have somebody with the set and then someone behind plugged into him with the headset on and things, and then the other fellow would be sort of protecting them, I guess. Quite often it worked out that the person carrying the set had the headset on as well, and, you know, the other two were just swanning around. I might mention that it was our feeling in the signals that we believed ourselves to be non-competent, that we really didn't feel that the time ought to come, then we would be involved in fighting in any way. We saw ourselves as providing a service to the company. We would keep them in touch, provide the communications, which were absolutely essential. But it was their job to protect us. So we hardly ever got ourselves in fighting positions if we could avoid it. And that was generally accepted. That was a tacit agreement that signals were fairly well, like the stretcher bearers, didn't do very much, and very few commanding officers asked us to get involved in actual fighting, unless things were quite desperate. So that was the last resort sort of thing.
I should really know this, but I don't. The 18 sets, you'd be talking, that would be, you wouldn't be sending it by buzzer.
No,
you'd be talking.
No, we hardly, I mean, that was hardly ever used. It was used the next level up. The next level up was from brigade backwards to division. And those people were Royal Corps signals. This is why, you know, I was keen to get into Royal Corps signals. And they did use Morse code there, backwards. But ours, because of the fact the thing was more immediate, you just spoke in straight. But you went, you were supposed to have security, and you used all sorts of ambiguous phrases and
such as
words. Let me think. Sunray was the commanding officer, the colonel, and they had other names. Tin cans were for tanks, of course. Pronto was the signals officer, I remember.
So you talked a sort of jargon.
A jargon, yes.
Which was not.
And you had a procedure, of course. You know, in the beginning they had one sort of alphabet, was an old alphabet. And it was ACAC, beer, beer, and that became something else later on. We used a sort of a joint one with the Americans. And it was ACAC, beer, beer, and it became Baker, Charlie, or something. I know it changed marginally.
What was the purpose of that alphabet? Sorry.
It became, you had signals on a network. The beginning of the operation usually was that you were given a wavelength on which you would all operate. And that was known as a network. And someone from battalion headquarters, who would be in charge of the group, would at a given time send out a call signal, which usually meant pressing the button on the side of the microphone, which was called a pressel switch, I think. And you sort of tuned your radio into that, and then you called up. Say Able Company reporting over, and they would report that, hearing you loud and clear, or that sort of thing, and then you would go through the whole of the network. And whenever you called up after that, you were Able Company, or Baker Company, or Charlie Company, or whatever. It was more likely that you had a letter, that was right, used Baker 2 was Baker Company, and Baker 3 was C Company, and this sort of thing. So all of these were decided, and you were given instructions about what the call was, and you had call signs, and you had passports. And what was most important, you had sort of reference numbers or code words for particular places that you were going to attack, and against which one might want to draw down artillery fire or whatever, which really was quite critical.
What was reception like?
Mostly pretty bloody. They didn't work terribly well. Of course, you were working in quite difficult conditions, mostly. In sort of mountainous areas, wasn't always easy. They didn't have a very wide area at all, perhaps only a mile or so, really, to be absolutely perfect condition. Sometimes, and we did as well as anyone could, the way it worked usually was that one was on the radio network in a sort of a mobile position, where it was understood that if you settled down to anything near a semi-permanent site, you would bring out the cables and you would put in a cable and telephone sets. And everyone, I mean, all of the officers preferred that, so they could just chat without anybody listening to them over the telephone network. But that really did depend upon you having a reasonably permanent sort of situation. It didn't often happen in wartime. And we were always very unhappy about laying cable because the cables, you know, got churned up by tanks and things and shot apart by mortars and shells and so forth. And it really was quite a hectic job going along a line and repairing it. I mean,
your network would be then a battalion network, or was it a brigade?
No, it was a battalion network. It was just from battalion headquarters out to the companies and only to the companies.
Would you be able to overhear the equivalent German system, or would they be able to overhear you? I mean, was there any security besides the codes?
No, no, so it was quite open.
They could hear us, yes.
But I think the only point was that the whole thing was happening so immediately that I doubt if it made a lot of difference. But, you know, it wasn't absolutely secure by any means.
Would you ever listen for German signals? Or?
We did hear them, and, you know, we didn't make an awful lot of them. I think we were more interested in finding music if we had any spare time. If we weren't actually on a network, we'd be listening into the forces network and trying to get some music or whatever.
You wouldn't be able to tune into anything but your own network particularly then?
No.
You couldn't sort of decide to get in touch with brigade. You'd have to go through your battalion.
Because, and for one thing, they wouldn't be on that sort of radio, or they wouldn't be on that sort of frequency. In our range, was very, very small anyway. I would guess, even on a very flat situation, I think about 5 miles would be about our limit in the sort of equipment that we had at the time. So,
the telephone equipment, you wouldn't be carrying that around. That would have been kept with the headquarters company.
Yes.
And that's where the decision would be made to roll it out otherwise.
They did use some of these spare people who were doing nothing very much to actually lay out lines. And they usually came out in fear and trembling with the lines and got a very dusty reception when they arrived. They thought it was altogether too bad after they'd come and they weren't used to it, through shot and shell laying out a line. They'd probably get the thick end of somebody's tongue when they arrived, because the last thing we wanted usually was a line to worry about, because once it was in, it was usually our responsibility to keep it open. And nobody enjoyed that particularly.
How did you go about repairing the line? Did you have...
Well, you had to go back along the line with it in your hand, you see. And there was certainly one situation later on where we came to where it was very dodgy indeed, where there was all sorts of infiltrations going along, and it was quite feasible that a German patrol could cut the line. And this did happen on one occasion. The line had been cut and just fastened together. Not properly joined as a cable job, just tied together. So obviously this had been done deliberately. And, we didn't lose anybody. It would be quite possible for the German to do this, just cut a line and wait for some unsuspecting signal to come wandering around and just chop him off. So, you know, nobody was very happy about that sort of thing. And usually it was a one-man job. You didn't take two men out to do it. So there you are, you're wandering off on your own along a line. And even if you did find it, and there was this occasion I remember.
We'll come to that.
We'll keep that
in sequence.
All right, then.
I've led you astray slightly
yes.
there.
Okay.
That's given me a good idea of the organisation and sort of role of the signals. If we get back to now, you were approaching Naples. You were still with the headquarters.
Yes.
Part there. If you take up the story from there.
Well, we had a victory parade through Naples. In effect, although there had been a proper parade earlier, we were in fact going through Naples to actually meet up with the line, which was beyond Naples, which was on the line of the next river, in fact, the Volturno. but we were in lorries, and the battalion went through Naples on the lorries, and all the inhabitants came out and cheered us, and it was great fun. Went right through Naples in these lorries with everybody cheering you. It wasn't the same as being on foot, because they couldn't come and embrace you or whatever, but whatever happened really in the end was quite funny in a way. They pelted us with apples, because it was the apple season. They were just collecting them at the end of the season. And they pelted us with apples all the way along. Well, apples are quite hard, and people were getting hurt by them, so we threw them back again. And before we got to the end of the run through Naples, there was a battle going on between people firing up apples from the lorries back at the civilians again. So it finished up really quite a conflict, truth be told. So that was how we got through Naples.
It sounds like it was a fairly jokey conflict.
Oh, yes, yes. But similar, apples hurt a bit. Round about this time, probably before, I just mentioned about the problem I had with latrine. If you were in a sort of a permanent position, anyway, reasonably permanent, you had to make provision for latrines, which were, generally speaking, dug out of the soil to a depth of about 2 yards, I say, and about a yard wide. And they had a trestle on with a big telegraph pole, and you squatted on the telegraph pole and did your business. And these holes were filled with lime or whatever. And there was a story that our signals officer fell in to one of these latrine pits. And I'm not sure whether it was true or not. It was just a story that went around. But the funniest thing about that was, we were there at the time that the grapes were just about ready, and people were gulping grapes down out of these vineyards as fast as they were going, and were getting dysentery on that account. And at one point in time, we had one of these latrine pits in a vineyard, so people could sit on the pole and just pick up handfuls of grapes from the vines that were just above their head while they were sitting on the poles. And we reckoned that was the nearest one could get to perpetual motion, as you are likely to see in this world. Otherwise, when you were in action, you took an entrenching tool and some paper and wandered off into the nearby land and dug yourself a hole, or didn't even bother to dig a hole, depending upon how hot the surrounding situation was, whether you were being shot or shelled or whatever. But latrines were organised if you had time.
Were you appointed to a company yet?
Yes. After, it was really before we left, we were all assigned. And I was assigned originally to D Company at that time, from then on in, with a new team, with a Lance Corporal. But then something happened and I got another Lance Corporal, and another fellow who were somewhat more experienced. So I was the junior member of that team at that point in time. And we had, on my very first experience, we had a bit of an adventure, really, which I may as well tell you. The next stage that we'd come to was that we were going to cross the Volturno. But before doing that, D Company was assigned this role of seeing whether some Royal Engineers had completed a bridge across a canal just before the Volturno at a place called Castel Volturno. So it was a company role, but I think only with two platoons, actually. But anyway, the signal terminal was part of this, and we were operating back to a set at battalion headquarters. We travelled in lorries first of all along the straight road, debussed, marched forward a few miles till we got to this canal, and the RAs were there building this bridge at one side. But we had to cross by boat, and the next few months of this campaign were about crossing rivers, usually with boats, which were generally a disaster. Nobody had any real experience.